Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. I am Carrie Weber, along with Father Matt Malone. And we're also joined by Olga Segura, one of our associate editors and our friend and colleague at America. And we momentarily will be speaking with Nick Rapatrazone about his work as a critic and writing about pop culture. But first, we want to talk a little bit more about this article that Olga, you're bringing to the table today about finding the Catholic voices in social justice poetry.
Correct. It's this piece written by Lisa Ampleman for us, where she focuses on questions like how do we live and act in solidarity with our neighbors, and sort of how these questions present themselves in poetry and literature. And it's an especially interesting piece because she talks about the state of social justice in Catholic poetry. And it comes almost a year after Dan Berrigan passed away, and he's usually the name that we think of when we think of Catholic social justice poetry, or art or writers in general. So this is a really great, strong piece, and it's especially necessary, I think, in this day and age when so many people are wondering, what is the role of Catholic, or where is the Catholic writer in poetry? So I thought it was a really great, strong piece.
Are there particular writers that you think are worth mentioning?
Yeah, she focuses on this writer called Maria Melendez Kelson, who is a Quaker poet but has very sort of Catholic themes in her work. And she focuses on this idea that you can be a Catholic poet without explicitly calling yourself a Catholic poet, which I think is something so significant in this day and age when we're wondering where these Catholic voices are in the arts, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think her work is especially powerful because she focuses on Latino culture, Catholic culture, you know, and the differences between sort of Caribbean Catholicism and American Catholicism in her work. So that's especially powerful.
I have to say that one of the things that, I really liked this piece because this is of course, social justice has always been a part of the art tradition within the faith, certainly after the Second Vatican Council. And in my own religious order, we had people like Daniel and Philip Berrigan, who were not only social justice activists, but were also poets. In fact, I think in print this week, this piece is accompanied by a poem about Daniel Berrigan.
Yes.
That we're printing. And I must say that I'm very happy that we still print poetry. I mean, there are a lot of magazines that used to do it that don't do it anymore. And of course, you know, I mean, I'm a son of Ireland, and so if I like banned the poets, I mean generations of Malones and McHughes would roll over in their graves and rise up to drag me and drown me in the Irish Sea.
Well, the Easter Rebellion was run by a lot of writers.
Sure was.
There's a history there of that dates even back beyond that.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And it does, you know, raise the question of, you know, what does it actually mean to be a quote-unquote Catholic poet? Or are you a poet who happens to be Catholic? Or are you a social justice poet? Or are you a poet who happens to have a passion for social justice?
Right.
So all these different questions of identity.
And how much does it matter whether the person self-identifies as that or whether the Catholic culture gloms onto it and says, like, look, there's Catholic themes. Let us look at this thing in pop culture that we want to sanctify and baptize. And because it can go either way. You could have a Catholic poet that writes nothing like that really enters into what we would traditionally think of as this sort of Catholic imagination. Or you could have people who have no religious faith or, you know, a different religious faith that really channel a lot of what the faith holds dear. So it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition and who gets to make that decision, right?
Right.
And who gets to say, yes, this is a Catholic poet. No, this is not a Catholic poet or artist or whatever that may be. The good thing that I like, well, one of the many things that I enjoy about Catholicism is that it touches on so much and that it's so open to this, that it doesn't see art and poetry and even pop culture that might not at first seem to be related to faith, it doesn't see that as a threat most of the time. Usually there's this, I mean, this, the Jesuit idea of God in all things applies in many of these cases, but it's this sense of, you know, the sacred in the everyday, the sacred in the, these works that we don't have to feel like, just because something isn't explicitly a religious, piece of art, that it doesn't relate to us and our relationship with God.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. And that's a great segue to our guest.
Yes, we, as we've mentioned, have Nick Rapatrazone on the line. Nick, how are you?
Great. How are you?
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you view the definition of a Catholic work of art or Catholic artist, and whether that relies more on the work that's produced, more on the person's self-identification, more on the audience. What are your thoughts?
I have a pretty wide definition of what Catholic art and Catholic artists includes. I would consider someone like Toni Morrison, who converted to Catholicism, would consider herself somewhat lapsed at this point, a Catholic writer, in the same way that I would consider Graham Greene and Flannery O'Connor writers who were very much, you know, quote unquote, practicing Catholics. I would consider them under the same, you're in the same sort of tent and umbrella. I think a lot of times people are surprised to hear Catholic themes in certain works. You know, I just had written something last week for The Atlantic, making the argument that Donnie Darko, 2001 film, was a very Catholic movie. And some people didn't necessarily agree with that or didn't see it. And then they kind of read the piece, and you know, I'm hoping I kind of opened some eyes to, you know, you find Catholicism in very surprising places artistically.
Right. This piece is in The Atlantic, called How Donnie Darko Captures the Spirit of Lent. And I have to say, I was excited to see this piece because this was a favorite film of mine in college. They would have midnight showings of it at this theater near my house when I studied abroad in England, and we would go and just stay up really late. We watched it twice in one day. I was mildly obsessed with this movie at times. Maybe I also had a crush on Jake Gyllenhaal. But I think it's a really fascinating film that has a lot to do sort of with what our fates are with this sort of odd Christ figure.
Yeah, I think that, like you say, it's a film that people tend to attach to. There's almost like an obsessive tendency, and I think part of that has to do with it's a juxtaposition of, just like you had been talking earlier on the show, of like the sacred and the everyday. You have a guy, Donnie, who is living in a suburban neighborhood, but he's having these supernatural experiences, and he becomes very much a Christ-like figure as the story goes on. It's not an allegory, but it definitely is an analogy, and I think it derives some power from that.
Right, and I think that relates to a little bit of what I was saying about liking that we can find that he is somewhat of a Christ figure and not be threatened by the fact that he's also sort of this really odd teenage boy in the suburban world. It doesn't
right.
threaten our idea of who God is by also seeing God in these characters.
Yeah, and I think part of, I'm most interested, I think, in Catholic art or Catholic film or Catholic literature that brings in a secular audience. I mean, I think, you know, one of the most profoundly Catholic films ever is The Exorcist, which also happened to be one of the most successful horror films ever. I don't think that, I guess, synthesis of popularity and Catholicity is a surprise. You know, I think people are open to these stories who may or may not be traditional believers.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true, and that's certainly in the spirit of, I think, people like Flannery O'Connor, who, as you say, was a Catholic writer, and at different times she had an ambivalent relationship with describing herself that way. But she actually wrote a piece for America Magazine once upon a time that was called The Catholic Fiction Writer. And in that piece she said that it is when the individual's faith is weak, not when it is strong, that he will be afraid of an honest fictional representation of life. And when there is a tendency to compartmentalize the spiritual and make it resident in a certain type of life only, the sense of the supernatural is apt gradually to be lost. So that there is a sense where, you know, that because, you know, fiction in her case is essentially narrating the action of grace in people's lives, and grace knows no bounds. It transcends time and space. If you restrict your imagination to a particular aesthetic or to a particular form of dogmatic expression, then you're going to miss that. And I think she would say, you're going to tell bad stories, stories that aren't that interesting.
I think the word you brought up there, dogmatic, I think great Catholic literature and other forms of art tends to be, I think, grounded in more theology than dogma. I think Catholic readers, but also certainly secular readers, tend to get turned off when they see someone who they feel is preaching to them, or they are assuming certain things about storytelling or belief. And I think O'Connor and other writers, like, you know, someone who's working now, Ron Hansen, in novels like Marriott and Ecstasy, he works for it. And, you know, when Ron Hansen read that, I think it was at the Breadloaf Writers Conference many years ago, the crowd was just kind of, they were rapt. They were just absolutely in awe of this. And people who believed and people who didn't believe, here was someone at the top of his game as a writer and as an artist, bringing people in through that work of theology rather than assuming dogma.
Mm. Now, there's been a kind of resurrection, so to speak, of Catholics in visible in popular culture. One of the things that we've seen is the young pope. And you wrote about this for America. You said that The Young Pope, which is the series on HBO starring Jude Law as the young pope, is, quote, the Catholic art that Catholics need but might not want. Now, what did you mean by that?
I was so happy to find out that there was a Catholic show on HBO. I basically told everyone that I knew about it. I think it's an incredible opportunity to put the sort of the mysticism and the complexities of the church and faith, you know, front and center. And the show was produced beautifully. It's a top-notch production. It has name actors and actresses. It's kind of everything in almost like a artistic evangelizing way that you could hope to have, you know, putting Catholicism up on a certain stage. It's a complex show, and part of the reason why I say, you know, Catholics might not realize that they need this is that it's not a purely devotional work. The young pope, the title character, is complex in his faith, and he's definitely imperfect. But I think Catholics sometimes want very neat representations of their faith when that faith itself is the antithesis of neat. It's complicated and surprising. Mm-hmm.
But you don't find that, I mean, you find it complicated and messy, but not necessarily, irreverent in the sense of it being, you know, insulting.
I never did. I watched it with my wife, another cradled Catholic, and we never felt, I mean, we were intrigued by it. It made us think. It never made us feel like it was demeaning the church. I mean, I don't think I would have really, as a viewer or as a critic, much interest in something that creates sort of the straw man of the church. I thought that it's a work by an Italian artist, and being someone who's Italian-American, I know that we have an interesting relationship sometimes with the institutional church and art.
Right.
I thought it was very, you know, sort of in that tradition.
Yeah, I thought so too. And, you know, I first watched it because somebody had told me that the young pope reminded them of me. Now, presumably, since I am not nearly as good-looking as Jude Law, I presume that this was because we had similar personalities. And then, of course, I started watching and I was like, what in the world does this person think of me? But, you know, but over the course of the series, you begin to see that this character is really complex and has a complex ecclesiology at work within him. And
much like yours.
I don't know about that. I don't know whether mine is like reductionist or overly metaphysical, but either way, I don't understand it or it's inadequate to the task. But what I also saw that complexity as and the nuance and the brokenness in the character as really making it authentically Catholic. Yeah.
I love those ideas of nuance and brokenness. Mm. That goes very well with so many aspects of our faith. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's so like aphoristic and quotable as a character. I mean, Jude Law is, you know, I think the perfect person to play him for those kind of one-liners. And I think that, you know, he sort of, he has like these sayings. He says, liturgy is no longer a social engagement. God overwhelms and God frightens. He has like, you know, in that sort of complexity, you want to, I think, remain and watch and see where the narrative takes him. And I do agree with you. It leads to some interesting places as a viewer.
Yeah. And I think Flannery O'Connor would have completely agreed with him about liturgy.
As a writer, I'm, I guess, always looking for Catholicism kind of finding its way in unlikely places. And, you know, I think for me, you know, there's poets like Natalie Diaz, who is a writer who's kind of gets to Catholicism from sort of the side door. You know, I would say that she has devotional moments in her poetry, but it's more often her work is kind of suffused with a Catholic culture and a Catholic feel. So I think people who are looking for work that announces itself directly as capital C Catholic all the time will have a hard time maybe finding it compared to the 60s, but people who are willing to look in sort of unlikely places will find it in a surprising amount.
Where is the least expected place that you have found it?
I would say that, I mean, the Donnie Darko thing kind of surprised people a lot because it's such a, for lack of a better word, was known as like the emo movie of like the early 2000s. It was sort of seen as like a kind of grungy suburban, you know, a movie that kids like loved in high school and then kind of grew out of. So I think for me, it's being open to finding Catholicism or being open to find God in work that doesn't necessarily seem religious in any way whatsoever. You know, the novels of Don DeLillo, for example, you know, DeLillo himself went to a Jesuit high school, Jesuit college, doesn't seem to be practicing right now. But you look, you know, people who are Catholic, at least, you know, people like me who almost like look for this stuff everywhere, you start to see the rhythms almost of the liturgy. You start to see the references that we kind of grow up with in the church. And then, you know, you see writers tapping into that in unusual ways. You know, there's an incredible amount of Catholics in the country, but there's also an incredible amount of lapsed Catholics. And, you know, I guess without naming names, like a lot of people that I've worked with in the secular publishing or editing world are those people who've grown up Catholic, who have a nostalgia for the church, who may or may not practice in a traditional way, but are so open to hearing these stories again. And there's a lot of them. And, you know, sometimes people, I know, think that Catholicism has receded into the cultural background. I think it's just taken on a different shape and color than it used to.
Well, I think for people who are raised Catholic, it's always in the foreground, whether it's consciously or not, in the sense that, you know, there is a certain sacramental imagination. There, you know, Rabbi Harold Kushner used to say, religion gives us eyes with which to see the world, but it's not as if it gives us a generic set of eyes. It gives us a set of eyes that's enculturated within a specific religious tradition. And for Catholics, it's a sacramental way of looking at the world. I remember once I on one of my trips to Cuba, I visited Santa Clara, where they have an enormous monument that is erected to contain the remains of Che Guevara. And, you know, you walk up these huge stairs and you walk through these golden doors and past these guards and into the center of this monument, where there is a small, what can only be described as a reliquary that holds the remains of Che Guevara. And above this very spot is the podium from where Castro would speak and give his talks and speeches. And that's where the liturgy took place. So I thought to myself, here we are in this communist, atheistic country, right? This is meant to symbolize everything that's opposed to what the church represents, and yet it's this obvious instantiation of a Catholic imagination at work. And I didn't particularly like finding that there, but I'd love to discover that in culture elsewhere, and that's what I like about your work.
Thank you. And I think, I mean, for artists who are maybe known as secular artists, I think the thing that draws them into the Catholic aesthetic is the idea that, you know, there's something fascinating about people getting together on a Sunday morning or a Sunday afternoon and having a ritual in the midst of the modern world, which is really what even secular art tries to accomplish. You know, secular poetry, secular fiction tries to pause the world long enough that we can see some eternal truth or look at the world in a different way. So the fact is that Catholic writers do that, but as you say, they bring in a sacramental vision into that world, and they don't aim to convert people, but I think their method sometimes does convert in the sense that they open people's eyes to the fact that God is everywhere at all times.
Right. And I think that subtlety is what makes it so attractive. It's not, you know, trying to teach somebody a lesson per se, but it acts more as an invitation. That's sort of just always there and always open. And then when someone's ready to hear it, they can enter into that work in a new kind of relationship. Do you find that the Catholic imagination is most present or most easily presented, perhaps, in one form of art versus another? You know, do you find it most in writing versus theater versus film versus studio art?
I think Hollywood has been fascinated with Catholicism, but really the spectacle of it, you do see sort of the elevated character of the priest, as you know, The Exorcist is probably the easiest example to think of. But I think what film allows is this sort of the performative celebratory elements of mass. You know, when people who've never been to a Catholic mass before go for the first time, it's a production, and not all are made equal in terms of production quality, but when you go to a great one, it is an experience of the senses, of the mind, of the soul. And I think, you know, the Catholic novel is a tough, you know, that could be a whole other debate to have, but those are, when they're done well, they're at a high level. But I think there's something about Catholic film, and I think a Catholic poem that has a certain power in its brevity. You know, Gerard Manley Hopkins has written many of these, like, that are so short that they kind of capture a certain sentiment or moment. But I think for the contemporary person right now, I think film and television, Netflix, those kind of places are the ways to get that Catholic aesthetic experience most directly.
Yeah, I was going to sort of jump off of what Carrie and Matt have said. I think that as Catholics, we don't have to find art that is super preachy or super explicitly Catholic. So, for example, I think I see elements of Catholicism in genres like hip-hop. So you see Kendrick Lamar has a recent album, and it's super heavily Christian, and it touches on themes that we talk about and write on at America all the time. And I think it's the same with horror. You know, you touched a little bit on The Exorcist, but what are some other films, and you've written about other films that are in the horror genre. So what are some other places where you see that in horror films or in music?
I think I mean, around the time of The Exorcist, you had films like Rosemary's Baby, where the lapsed faith of the main character creates sort of the hole in which, you know, some of the terrible things that happen occur. But you have sort of the idea of Catholicism in films like Rocky, sort of this urban right. kind of Philly Catholicism. You have anything from Man for All Seasons, The Sound of Music. But, you know, in terms of more contemporary work, when The Exorcist reboot came out on television earlier or late last year, my concern was, you know, would a contemporary audience be open to this stuff? And I think the young Pope kind of stepped in and took the place of that, because I think what contemporary audiences want to see is they want to see that kind of the mysticism that brings them in. And once you have an audience hooked, just like a great storyteller, once they have us hooked, then we're willing to listen to things that we don't normally open ourselves to. And I think that's why when you bring up hip-hop and other forms of music, there are so many artistic layers in there, from lyrics to arrangement to beat to sound. They sort of capture that mentality or that openness to Christianity that other forms of art might not be able to. And I think, as mentioned before, I think the last thing that great art does is tell us what to think or how to think. I think it gives us possibilities and opportunities. And when it surprises us, when it catches us off guard, that's probably when it's at its most successful.
And it's a funny thing. That's precisely what faith is supposed to do, right? It's not supposed exactly. to tell you how to think or what to think. It's supposed to give you a way of thinking and being in the world, and the ability to ask questions and to discover truth. And that's so. I think, you know, if art is doing that, it's doing in some way the work of faith.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Nick Patrizzoni is a writer for The Atlantic, and his pieces for America Magazine can be found at americamagazine.org. And are you going to the Catholic Literary Imagination Conference at Fordham?
I wish I was, but unfortunately I'm not able to.
Oh, that's too bad. But our listeners should still go. It's called The Future of the Catholic Literary Imagination, Thursday, April 27th to Saturday, April 29th at Fordham University Lincoln Center here in Manhattan. It is co-sponsored by Fordham University and America Magazine. And you can find out more about it at fordham.edu or americamagazine.org. Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Our own literary editor, Father Ray Schroth, who's been writing for America Magazine since 1957, mm-hmm. is going to be one of the featured speakers at this conference, as is yours truly.
And I'll be with you.
I'll be dressed all in white. I'll be coming as the young Pope.
As the young Pope, smoking a cigarette on stage.
That I might do anyway.
Well, that could make you look very literary.
Right. And are you presenting at the conference?
I am
too?
Presenting with you on
oh,
the
oh,
same
right,
stage.
Yes, of course. I knew that.
I'm sure you did.
That was a test for you.
I thought so.
That somehow I failed.
No, we will be there together. And yeah, it'll be enjoyable.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is a conference that has taken place now every couple of years and held throughout the country. And we are really pleased to be able to sponsor it with Fordham here in New York, April 27th to April 29th at Fordham University Lincoln Center, The Future of the Catholic Literary Imagination. That's it for America This Week. To read more about all of these stories, you can join us at americamagazine.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Carrie Weber and Olga Segura, thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.